Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present, with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
This was a much more polished Italian team than in 1934. And for their second goal, Italy gave the Hungarians a dose of their own medicine. Miazza passing when it was easier to score before Piola finished it off. Three major finals in the 1930s. Three opponents from the Danubian school. And the Italians had beaten them all.
Hi. And welcome to another edition of the Political Football, the World Cup series, from These Football Times. After 4 series looking around the globe and back through time to examine how football and politics have always seemed to be inevitably and inextricably linked together as part of the social fabric of life, we're taking a different tack with this series. We're looking at the World Cup tournaments from the very beginning right up into the recent one, and indeed looking into the future as well. We've got some brilliant guests lined up, without exception, we've got another one online here, followed up on the first episode we had in 1930. Today, we're looking at 1938, and it's a tournament that's got so many political connotations that it might take us about 3.5 hours to get through it. Alongside me is my usual political football comrade in arms, Stu Horsfield. How are you doing, Stu?
Yeah, good, thank you, Gary. Very well, as always. I've put 50p in the slot, and I'm ready for another hour's of education.
It's another school day for us, buddy. It is. Who's our guest today, mate?
So today's guest, one of my favourites, by the way, is Mr. Aidan Williams. Aidan's obviously a senior writer at These Football Times. Enjoys using the platform to delve into some of the areas of football that interest him the most. More often than not, this is related to international tournaments, as this is what has always captivated him more than the club game, and perhaps even more so now the elite game has become so moneyed.
Hi there, guys. How you doing?
Good to see you, matey. Well, good to hear you anyway.
It is.
So, very much looking forward to this one, guys. There's so many political areas to get into around this, of course. We'll try to cover all the conflict that the world was about to descend into. And as long as Stu keeps his questions nice and easy, we'll not descend into any conflict here either.
I can't guarantee that. I think we have a massive thanks to you and obviously Paul, the first episode, to put your hands up for these really early tournaments, where I guess a lot of listeners won't know anything about these early tournaments. And 38 is almost a little bit hidden by the other things that were happening around the world at the time. So I'm sure this is going to be interesting and educational for so many listeners, as well as Stu and myself.
Yeah, let's hope so. I mean, you're right, it is slightly forgotten about, I guess, because, you know, the first tournament's big news because it's the first, and then the second was so Mussolini-dominated that this one, I think it does get a little bit forgotten about, probably because, you know, the war was about to happen, and there's bigger things and all of that. It just seems slightly less well-known, but we'll try and shed some light on that tonight.
That's what I'd like to hear. So tell us why you chose this, why you're brave enough to stick your hand up for the 1938 World Cup, Aidan.
Well, we already looked in depth at quite a lot of the political aspects of the 1934 World Cup in your last series, when we looked at Mussolini and his fascist influence on the 34 World Cup. And obviously there was quite considerable overlap from that into 1938. On the Italian team, of course, which won them both. Deeply political connotations surrounding Italy's and the fascist victory there. And obviously there's a little more depth we can go into around Italy, but there's plenty of other political aspects to the 1938 tournament, obviously as a consequence of the global politics at the time, which obviously everyone knows the headline story of what they are, but there's quite a few subplots to it all that we'll delve into. Obviously, the world was about to descend into World War, but by 1938, a lot was already changing, or had already changed in the lead-up to that. So it wasn't just that it was about to descend into chaos. There was a lot already happening, and a lot of that had an impact on this tournament. The impact was obviously greater in other areas, but it was still felt in football. Sport and football at this time, as we sort of mentioned a bit in the 34 podcast, in the last series, was rather than being used to unite nations and bring them together in peace, it was generally being used as an effective vehicle for political propaganda. Obviously, Mussolini 34 and then Hitler took that to in a different, even greater direction in the Berlin Olympics 2 years later. This follows off straight on the back of all of that. Italy had exploited the previous World Cup, and their win helped to emphasise the political aspects of it, to emphasise the progress the regime had made, I guess. The subsequent Olympics were even more abused. Italy won the football there as well, which kept Mussolini nice and happy too. So the 34 World Cup was basically expected to be the next sporting area to be used as this political pawn. Purely in terms of history, aside from football, it's a fascinating era as well. As someone who quite enjoyed history at school, oddly enough, it was one that was an era that's very interesting to me. So adding football and the World Cup into that mix makes it all the more compelling as an area of interest for me. And if this podcast series you're doing shows nothing else, it shows that the political impact on the World Cup is as true today as it was in the 1930s, which some of your future episodes will no doubt come into in great detail. But given when this tournament occurred, it's unique even amongst the rich history of FIFA and politics, given it's got a world war around the corner. So it makes for an interesting area to look into, and hopefully an interesting podcast as well.
What a great start, buddy. And just worth just throwing in as a side, if anybody wonders why we've gone from 30 to 38, is as I had alluded to there, we covered 1934 in the series four previously. And it's worth mentioning that Stu and I enjoyed that pod with Aidan so much that it was after that that Stu came up with the suggestion of doing a World Cup series. So basically, Aidan, this is all your fault.
Good stuff. Glad to have been of service.
Yeah, no. Yeah, did you kick off with Stu?
Just if any future guests come on and are really, really good, they need to be careful that they don't just trigger an entire new series around something else. It's like I say, I'm really excited because I agree with. I mean, I wasn't great at school, and I do like history, and as you know, as Ian's alluded to, really sort of 34 and then 36 Olympics, 38 World Cup. They are so mired in politics and almost global change, right across the planet with the war and it, and the tournaments itself are obviously in history class and traditional history lessons are completely forgotten about, but just sometimes in sport you get a great microcosm of what was actually happening in the world, but through a medium that perhaps if I'd been taught history through football, I probably would have been a better student. So I am, like I say, well, now I've got loads of questions. I've got them already, but it's going to be fascinating, absolutely fascinating.
It's similar to how you learn about places around the world, isn't it? And it is. Half the places in Europe because of football teams. And you're right, putting sport or history, into this football context just adds to the allure of it, and it gives it a bit more meaning.
It does. It absolutely does. So anybody who's studying for their GCSEs or A-levels history and European history really need to take a listen to this. But that's it. Anyway, that's it. That's my piece done on the national curriculum.
Education via these football times.
That's right. So many services, Gary, that we provide. Yeah.
That's wonderful. Okay, so just to get us going, having sort of covered the background, Aidan, it must have been, I would say difficult isn't the right word, it must have been a bit of a game to find a country that could host the World Cup in such a traumatic time, just ahead of the conflagration of the Second World War. So can you tell us a little bit how the tournament came to be awarded to France?
Well, yes, the straightforward answer to this is that France were given it at the 1936 FIFA Congress in Berlin, largely in tribute to Jules Rimet, the French FIFA president who'd, he had, of course, been the driving force behind the creation of the World Cup, as you talked about a lot in your first episode of this series. Another way of looking at that, though, would be that he used his influence to bring the tournament home. He basically held sway and made sure that it was coming to France. He'd actually pushed for it to be held in 1937 to coincide with a world fair that was held in Paris that year. That would have made things rather more economically affordable, of course, but the Congress went for the costlier option. But in doing so, they sort of preserved the four-yearly cycle, as well as removing any risk of the World Cup becoming a sideshow to the World Fair. Now, that, you know, going back further into the mists of sporting history, that had been the case with some of the early Olympic Games. But you're probably only talking 25, 30 years ahead of the time we're talking about here. So it's not that far removed for such events to have been forgotten, but Olympics were overshadowed in some way. So this, thankfully, helped avoid the World Cup being a similar fate. The choice of venue was also influenced by the travelling difficulties, which had put off most European teams from going to the first World Cup in Uruguay in 1930. Politically, it was also seen as a safe, neutral venue. That was following on from, obviously, the political chicanery around the 1934 World Cup and 36 Olympics. But it was also seen as a tribute to the birthplace of the tournament's founder and of FIFA itself, which was founded in France too. Therefore, it was intended to be a location that nobody could either overtly politicise or complain about. However, that's all fine in theory, of course, and as practical as all of that sounds, it was far from a popular choice. So the South Americans were, of course, angered by the prospect of another European World Cup. Argentina were feeling the most put out because they felt that it was their turn to host. They thought they were entitled to have it. Uruguay had obviously already hosted. And on the basis of alternation between Europe and South America, they confidently expected this to happen. Argentina would, of course, also counted as a neutral political host compared to Italy or Germany in the previous two big major sporting events, but wasn't to be. Uruguay were also severely angered. They were put out because, of course, they felt that many European nations had failed to support their tournament. Only four European countries went over to Uruguay, whereas Uruguay and Argentina had frequently travelled to Europe for Olympic tournaments beforehand. They both didn't come to the 1934 World Cup for this reason, and they were obviously still annoyed about it by 1938, and they didn't come either. They were, of course, the strongest footballing nations in South America at that time, more so than Brazil, who were closing the gap a bit, but when the decision went to host another European tournament, Argentina protested rather loudly. They took the hump, basically, and boycotted completely. They briefly changed heart late on. Late entry got in, but they withdrew it again. Possibly it was just too late, I don't know. There was little popular support in Argentina for this boycott, however, so there were huge demonstrations by fans outside the Argentinian FA in Buenos Aires, which the police ended up having to break up. So even the simple act of awarding the tournament caused some sort of political turmoil in some quarters of the globe. While the intentions were, of course, fairly understandable, the awarding of the tournament came with a huge dose of wrangling and political implications that recent global sporting events had been mired in. So this weighed very heavily on those decisions, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. Stu?
To be fair, this is something that I've thought about quite often but never actually been able to find a true answer. This alternating of tournaments between Europe and South America, was this, a gentleman's agreement, or was this ever enshrined in FIFA law that these tournaments would alternate?
Not at this time, no. I think it was more an assumption on behalf of the South Americans that, given they'd had to travel over to Europe so many times for... So the two Olympic Games prior to the 1930 World Cup were both in Western Europe, that Uruguay won. So obviously they'd all trooped over for the football there. Not many people had gone to South America in return. So I think it was their assumption that since this was a football tournament and football was powerful in South America as it was in Europe, that this would just happen because it began that way. So okay, they saw this very much as their turn.
Okay. To be fair, it's something, I mean, not so much now it goes, you know, across, you know, multiple continents now, and probably rightly so, but, you know, as I was growing up, it was always alternating between Europe and South America, and I always wondered, but could never really find a definitive answer as to whether it was just, like you say, an assumption, Aidan, that actually they would, for sake of fairness, for want of a better word, that's how it would operate.
Yeah, I mean, I think even in more recent times, I don't know if that ever became enshrined. It just sort of happened that way as well. And it was always, I know much more recently, there was the rotation between all the confederations. Mm. But through the sort of 60s and 70s, I don't think that was official necessarily either. But it certainly wasn't at this time, no. But it caused ructions, it's fair to say. Mm.
It's an interesting point about you mentioned about Uruguay, Aidan. And obviously they didn't go to Italy in 1934, and Italy didn't go to Uruguay in 1930, but the French did. The French went to Uruguay in 1930, so Uruguay is saying, well, you know, you didn't come to our World Cup, we're not coming to yours. Actually, the French did go to their World Cup, didn't they?
They did, absolutely, and they were the opening fixture, or at least the opening goal was by a Frenchman, wasn't it?
So
I think, yeah. I mean, partly they kind of were influenced to go by Jules Rimet, I would imagine. But therefore, yes, why would there be any antagonism, to France hosting? But I think it's purely this feeling put out that it was their turn. Why should we have to come to Europe again when you just hosted it?
Yeah.
And equally, the preceding Olympic tournament was, of course, in Europe as well. So it was very Eurocentric.
Yeah, I guess you know the prospect of taking it to Argentina. I mean, obviously there was a lot of vast political problems in Europe at the time, and you know, taking it to Argentina would have perhaps been a more neutral, shall we say. But obviously, there's a lot of things going on in the background of the general history of world politics at the time. So, do you want to sort of fill us in a bit more about that before we jump into the tournament?
Sure. Are you ready for this? There's quite a lot here of things going on. Not all good at all.
We're making notes.
I feel like this is a GCSE klaxon alert rather than a YouTube alert. Go, Aidan.
We'll have a test at the end, so let's see how you
do. Oh, no.
Right. Well, as we've already mentioned,
that's pen points, fire away.
Well, it's not overstating things to say the world was basically on the brink of turmoil at the time when this World Cup we're going to discuss was taking place. So World War II was a little over a year away, but much of the world was already embroiled in conflict of one kind or another, and a lot of that had a bearing on this tournament in one way or another. So Spain was in the midst of its civil war that had been going on since 1936. Franco's forces had made big incursions into the Republican areas by this time, and they demanded unconditional full surrender by mid-1938. So that's what was happening at the time of this tournament. Obviously, the ultimate victory took a little while later, but it was all heading that way. But at the time of this tournament, that's where we were there. Soviet Union also was in various bits of turmoil. They were in the midst of the Great Purge, or the Great Terror, as it's sometimes referred to, which was basically eliminating political opponents, army leaders, ethnic minorities, and many more besides. This had begun like the Spanish War in 1936, but it was still very much going on in 1938. Italy, who obviously we've got quite a vested interest in for this tournament, they'd been fighting in Abyssinia for much of the preceding 3 years with their attempted empire building. Much closer to home, they'd also signed an Anglo-Italian agreement, which was the Easter Accords. That was just 2 months or so prior to this World Cup tournament. It was meant to lead to a bit of cooperation between the Italian government and the UK government, aimed at keeping the existing world order to prevent an alliance with Germany. At least that was the aim from the British side. From the Italian side, it was essentially meant to hope that they ensured Britain's neutrality, when Italy invaded France, which they obviously had a mind to do. Germany, by this stage, speaking of invasions, they'd already seized the Rhineland, had taken over the Saar region, and 3 months prior to this tournament, March 1938, they'd annexed Austria in the Anschluss. Now, this is something we'll come on to in due course, I think, because this has huge implications on this World Cup. Austria had been incorporated into the Greater Germany, and yes, that changed the lineup, shall we say, for this tournament. Germany's attention next was going towards the Sudetenland, a part of Czechoslovakia. Now, Czechoslovakia had been runners-up in the previous World Cup. They did take part in 1938, but the situation at home was very much expecting an imminent invasion. The British and French had told the Czechs to concede to Hitler's demands, believing, of course, the ambitions were limited. By May 1938, Czechoslovakia, however, was mobilising ahead of this potential invasion, which in the end did come to pass. That was a bit after the World Cup tournament, which of course then led to Neville Chamberlain's piece of paper and peace in our time and all of that, but that's how well that went. In the Far East too, which does have a little bit of implications in World Cup, which I'll touch on in due course, but in terms of political situation, Japan had occupied Manchuria, as well as having a long-term annexation of Korea. So by 1938, they were in full conflict with China in a whole number of locations. The Americans were being drawn into that issue with relations strained on both sides. Japan had also attacked Vietnam in 1938 as well. So a lot of the Far East conflict was very much in full swing already. America itself, again, who'd been quite active in the early World Cup, semi-finalists in 1930, as you discussed in the previous episode, they were still suffering the effects of the Great Depression by this point. The boost that Roosevelt's New Deal had given them had improved some areas. Unemployment had been falling and so on. But by 1937, unemployment rose rapidly again. Essentially, it dipped into another recession, perhaps rather than another depression, but its rise actually fell again. So the peak unemployment was 1938, which coincided with the lowest industrial production for quite some time too. So this economic collapse, obviously that had implications for millions, and it caused the Americans to pass a number of neutrality acts, which made the country much more isolationist. And that, combined with economic conditions, hampered the Americans' attention to this World Cup. Well, in terms of the qualifying, they withdrew at that stage. So against this backdrop, this World Cup tournament, very much in its infancy, seems rather trivial in comparison, of course. You know, it's much more important things going on, but nothing exists in isolation, which you're, what are you, fifth series now? Obviously, nothing exists in isolation in terms of football and politics. So the tournament must, of course, be viewed in this political setting of the time, which hopefully this has given a little bit of an indication of just how dire it was and all the implications that the state of the world has on a mere football tournament.
Wow. That's I've had to charge my pen three times there to keep all the notes in there.
My grade's just gone up from a C to a B+. I suppose two things here, and they're quite, I suppose, conflicting questions. One is, was there any chance that the world was so volatile and so much upheaval that this tournament wouldn't go ahead? Or, just before you answer that one, or was... I know sport can seem trivial, like you just said there, which is a great point. You know, this trivial tournament, and obviously we have to remember the World Cup wasn't the event that it is now. But was the World Cup almost like an attempt to show that actually the world could harmonise and that nations could come together? You know, I'm not saying it could ever have stopped war. That's not it. I would never be so glib to say such a thing. But I'm sort of torn between how this tournament was ever played, or was it a last attempt on a global scale to show that actually nations could come together, nations could harmonise, nations could coexist in a small space, if you like.
To look at the second part of that first, I think there is at this time still a very strong belief that there isn't going to be a big war. I think that therefore everyone thinks that sport, as you say, can harmonise and bring people together, and therefore, why would they not host it? It's easy, I guess, to look with hindsight to see, well, yes, you're a year away from World War, and already a lot of that is on the cards. But at the time, but many people obviously still thought this could be avoided. Just look at the UK stance at the time for clear evidence of that, even though they obviously had nothing to do with the World Cup. But politically, that was a viewpoint that wasn't just Britain's alone. So I think, yeah, there was absolutely no reason why they wouldn't go ahead with it, because much of the world wasn't in conflict, and Europe itself, while there had been, obviously Spain was at conflict and Germany had expanded already, it hadn't been yet done in terms of Germany, at least in terms of war. That was still to come. And I think, the prevailing mood was that there wasn't actually going to be a war. Something would happen. Somebody would sort it out. similarly, yes, the overall viewpoint that sport will make it all better and help everyone get along great, despite the evidence of 1936 and 1934. I don't know why you would think that, but I still think a lot of people thought that sport and politics weren't one and the same in so many ways. But I think we all know better than that.
I think we do.
Excellent.
Mate, I think.
Yeah, excellent.
It's interesting just looking at, you know, some sort of touch on the subject of who was there and who wasn't there. And there's a few strange names that people, you know, wouldn't associate with qualifying for the World Cup. The Dutch East Indies qualified and Cuba qualified. But I never want to sort of leave Austria to one side for a second because we've got to go into some depth about Austria. Is there any other countries or areas that opted out or didn't go for other reasons that it's worth switching before we jump into Austria?
Well, yes, indeed there are. So you mentioned the Dutch East Indies. That's now Indonesia. For those not aware of the political history of that area, they basically qualified by default. So obviously there's a big caveat here that Asian football at this time was considerably weaker than European and South American. So we can't claim that Japan, for example, would have been contenders for this tournament necessarily. However, they were a team that had beaten Sweden 3-2 in the 1936 Olympic football tournament. Sweden themselves would go on to reach the semi-finals of 1938. So we can't discount them completely as a team that wouldn't have at least put up a decent showing. That Olympic success, that's the first time an Asian side had had actually competed in the World Cup or Olympic Games football competition, and it was the first time, obviously, one of them had been victorious. Japan weren't alone there. China played in that Olympic tournament as well. They lost 2-0 to Great Britain, of all teams, but Japan were the strongest of the Asian nations at that time. And, well, I guess in a parallel to the situation with Germany and Austria that we'll come on to, Japan had annexed Korea in 1910, which effectively made the Japan team made up of Japanese and Korean players. It was a bigger selection pool, if you like. So the national team at the 36 Olympics had several Korean players in, or at least a couple anyway, which, if you look back through Asian football history, that's effectively the two strongest football areas in Asia at the time, all playing under one flag. So they were the strongest team around at the time, but by July 1937, the Second Sino-Japanese War had started, and Japan therefore withdrew from World Cup qualifying. They had other things to focus on, of course. This left the Dutch East Indies to qualify by default without having to play. So that's how they ended up there. They're not the only ones to qualify without playing. There was a raft of withdrawals from North and Central America. We mentioned the USA and its sort of economic difficulties at that time. And Uruguay, of course, refused to travel in terms of South America. But in terms of Central America, yes, Cuba qualified, which you mentioned earlier, Gary. They would have been up against Mexico, El Salvador, and a few other countries who were part of the official draw originally, but didn't take part for less political reasons than some of the others. But those who should have taken part and would have been strong but didn't, obviously we've talked a little bit about Spain, they clearly couldn't enter because of their civil war. They were thoroughly embroiled in that at the time. They were a strong nation as they are now. They'd been rather unlucky to be beaten in the quarterfinals of the previous World Cup. They lost out to Italy only after a replay and after they'd had their goalkeeper kicked out and various other players injured in the first match against Italy, and then they lost the replay, only 1-0. No official matches have been played by Spain since mid-1936, so obviously they didn't take any part in qualifying either. Many of the national team players for Spain actually came from either the Basque Country or Catalonia. Now, these were initially in the Republican territory, but the Basque country had been taken over by Franco's forces by this point. The Basque team itself, actually, so there was a bit more focus, if we take a slight detour away from the World Cup for a moment. They'd been playing in Russia at the time, in Moscow, on tour. So when Franco's forces captured Bilbao in 1937, they were away and they didn't come back for some time. They kept touring Russia, then they went to Norway, Denmark, then they crossed the Atlantic to Mexico, Argentina, and Chile, Mexico again, and then Cuba, of all places. So many of the players just decided, right, we'll just stay over here now. It's much nicer than going back to that defeated area that they'd come from. So that was the end of a great team from Spain. The Soviets, I've mentioned, obviously, they were in the midst of political turmoil, of great purges. They hadn't been a particularly active participant as a national team in this era. I don't think they'd taken part in any of the World Cup qualifying up till this point. But they did have quite a rich history from the previous Russian Empire national team and then a Soviet team in the early 20s. But their priority was obviously elsewhere too. And then, of course, as England, they were not a part of the qualifying process at all, although close to home, the Irish Free State did take part but lost out. From a political perspective, though, to bring in the sort of theme of the time, we probably should mention that the England team had played their infamous friendly in Berlin just a month or so prior to this World Cup. So that was May 1938, and only a few weeks after the German annexation of Austria. So that's obviously something that we all know quite well, the players under instruction to give the Nazi salute and all of that. That's quite a big controversial moment in the history of British sport, but we probably see that as separate from World Cup history because obviously England had no part of it. But if you sort of plug it into its right position in the timeline, it was after the German annexation of Austria and a month or so before the World Cup. So it's all feeding into the same political mix.
Yeah, and you know, I guess one of the perhaps the biggest team that wasn't there, I wouldn't say biggest in terms of most sort of successful, powerful, was the Austrian Wunder team, obviously because the country had been annexed by the Germans at the Anschluss. So I guess that's a massive point to talk about in this World Cup.
Yeah, I mean, all these other political subplots are just kind of leading us to the biggest issue of the World Cup. So there's two big ones. Italy, in terms of the World Cup, is one, and the other, as you rightly say, there is Austria. They were, of course, the most conspicuous absentee from the tournament. If you focus on footballing issues, firstly, they'd been semi-finalists in 1934. They, like Spain that we mentioned there, they also narrowly lost out to Italy, just 1-0 again. Well, if you listen to our previous pod, you'll hear there's various rumours around that game. They'd also lost in the final of the 1936 Olympics, again to Italy. So their famous Wunder team, they were, of course, one of the finest sides in world football throughout the early 1930s. I think they were a little bit past their peak by 1938. 34 was probably their big chance, but they would still have definitely been a key contender. They were clearly still a strong team. But Austria was no more. It had been swallowed up by Hitler's Germany in the Anschluss in March 1938. So with Austria ceasing to exist, obviously, so too the Austrian national team ceased to exist. They'd qualified, though. They took part in all of that. They only had to play one game. They beat Latvia comfortably. So ultimately, though, this fine team would basically go down as one of the greatest sides never to lift the World Cup. So, to my mind, you can lump them in with Hungary, Holland, and Brazil for you, Stu, in 1982.
Yes,
as one of the greatest sides never to win it. It, you know, they don't generally come into that conversation because I guess it's so long ago, and also they didn't quite reach the final stage. They only had one tournament where they could have had more, and they only reached the semi-final. But yeah, I think they ought to be in that conversation too. They've been led by the sort of forward thinking ahead of his time, Hugo Meissel. They had all sorts of talented players. The great Matthias Sindelar was the chief amongst them. And in terms of the politics of the time, so Sindelar their finest player. He made no mystery at all of his dislike for the Nazi regime or his more social democratic political leanings. Obviously, for balance and context, we should note that many Austrians were, of course, fully behind the amalgamation into Greater Germany, but a lot of the footballing community wasn't, because football in Austria, like in Hungary and Czechoslovakia at that time, was very much an intellectual pursuit, or at least the leadership of it, the tactics of it, the school of thought, the Danubian school. It was all from the intellectual coffee houses that stemmed, and therefore the slightly more left-leaning politics was more their thing. His final match for Austria, or actually more accurately for the German state of Ostmark, as it was now called after the Anschluss, this came in a so-called reconciliation match. So this was about 1 month after the Anschluss. So around about the same time, or similar time to when Germany were playing England, obviously not at the same time, but very close to that, they played each other to essentially to mark the birth of a new united team. Now, Sindelar and his team had received orders not to score against Germany, allegedly, we should say. The Austrians were clearly the stronger side, but he proceeded to miss, in inverted commas, several chances in the first half. And the legend, of course, has it that he was missing on purpose. This neatly fits our narrative from looking back from this era of looking for great heroes to resist the Nazis. But certainly many reports show that he missed an awful lot of chances in the first half, which was quite unlike somebody of his talent. Come the second half, he was unable to contain his frustration any longer, so the story goes. So he scored Austria's first goal and then danced wildly in celebration in front of the watching high-ranking Nazi dignitaries, which probably wasn't the wisest move. But anyone who knows his story, he died in January 1939 in what does seem suspicious circumstances. He died of carbon monoxide poisoning while he slept. But there's all sorts of myths saying that he was killed off by the Nazi regime, but the real evidence actually suggests it was an accident due to dodgy heating or something along those lines, which doesn't quite fit the story, but there we go. So before the 1938 World Cup, Germany, the national team, was led by Sepp Herberger. Of course, he would go on to win the World Cup in 1954 with West Germany, so he was pleading for several of the main Austrian players to take part, and specifically Sindelar, but he refused. His official reason was old age, but it's fair to say, I think, that his political and nationalistic reasons are actually the truth of that. A handful of Austrian players did play for the Germany team, however. Four of them, in fact, featured in their opening match against Switzerland, which I'll come on to in a second. But to just finish off Austria's story, their withdrawal left the plays open in the tournament, of course. We were down from 16 to 15 teams at quite a late stage. The FIFA secretary at the time actually did send a plea to the English FA chief at that time. That was Sir Stanley Rapp, who was a bit of an internationalist when it came to football and the global view. But this was declined, of course, as we know. So therefore, we only started with 15 teams, only three of which were from outside Europe. So it's not really that much of a global tournament, but I think that was probably par for the course at this time as well. Now, this leads us into Germany, I guess. So Germany, their propaganda battle at the 1936 Olympics in Berlin had obviously been spoiled by Jesse Owens, as many people will know. But what is less well known is that it was also spoilt to some extent by having a poor football team. Now, they were knocked out by Norway in the Olympic Games, and that, sadly for them, was the only football match that Adolf Hitler ever went to, and he clearly did not enjoy that. So by the time of the 1938 World Cup, there were these several Austrians in the squad. However, this, given that they were better players than many of the Germans, this should have improved the strength of the squad overall, but actually it weakened them rather than strengthened them, because any prospect of squad harmony and teamwork essentially went out of the window with this newly merged side. Now, Austria, they'd beaten Germany quite regularly through the 1930s. They, you know, their superiority was clear and clearly evidenced. But the two factions were essentially two teams within a team. They ate separately, they socialised separately, and at times I think they more or less played separately. The Austrians passed to the Austrians, the Germans passed to the Germans, and you're never going to get far like that. So we mentioned their opening game. This was against Switzerland in Paris, and this was in front of a very hostile anti-fascist crowd. There was bottles being hurled from the stands at the players, and obviously the noise was very much in against the Germans and in Switzerland's favour. Now, there was a 1-1 draw, and in those days that meant a replay had to be played. Germany were leading this 2-0. The first goal, in fact, had come from an Austrian, William Hahnemann, but the Swiss won through 4-2. Now, Sepp Herberger, who we should point out, he joined the Nazi Party in 1933. He was furious with this defeat, and he blamed this squarely on the attitude of his Austrian players not wanting to win for the German team. So what should have seen them strengthened actually harmed them. So the political situation not only destroyed Austria's hopes, it therefore destroyed Germany's hopes too. But one final thing on this, just to add to the political intrigue of it, was that the Swiss coach, a man called Karl Rappan, he was Austrian. So that was rather nice for him, I'm sure. So he was a forerunner. The system he used was a forerunner to the Catenaccio system, quite a revolutionary move for the time, of course, but an extra defender and trying to sort of keep things much tighter at the back. But I think it's fair to say the political symbolism of an Austrian knocking the Germans out and a Germany with half the team who were Austrians not wanting to win for Germany is hugely significant, I think.
Brilliant. I mean, it must be a bit rapid. I mean, for people who didn't know, that's the reason that it was originally called the Swiss Bolt, the Catenaccio, because it was Rappan's Swiss team that pioneered the system. Steve?
Yeah, I mean, Aidan, you know, everything you've just gone through there was, you know, it was brilliant. It was absolutely fascinating. And I think what, for me, as, you know, sat there listening, I think a question that I would have, or that I was thinking at the time, is do you think that the footballing legacy of these tournaments have been diminished based on the political situations of the world at that time? So when you talk about the teams that either didn't travel from South America through obstinacy, that Austria never played, you know, in the 1938 World Cup tournament, and you're right, I agree, they do deserve to go in with Hungary and the Dutch and the Brazilians. But to me, the legacy of these early tournaments from a football perspective, it could have been so much better and it could and should have been viewed, I suppose, you know, in history as, you know, could potentially have been great tournaments, but for the political situation at the time.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bit of that. I mean, all three of the 1930s World Cups had issues about lack of participation, didn't they, in one way or another? So that has to come into it when you consider how we should view not just the winners, but those who reached the latter stages or those who took part. I mean, obviously the one big issue over all of them is that the British teams didn't take part. Now, England and Scotland would have been contenders in each one of them, I would imagine, in terms of the strength that they'd historically had. So that's always going to be a question mark over them. But with that said, by the 1930s, England and Scotland they certainly weren't beating all comers, despite what people may have thought at home. They were struggling against European opposition on a number of occasions. They'd lost games away, which is something that's often forgotten about when we think about the big defeat in 1953 as a turning of the tide there. So, yeah, maybe they weren't necessarily the best, but they would have been contenders. So that's always going to be a question mark over the legacy of these tournaments. I think partly, too, is that, as we're talking politics, the political situation, which was quite unique at the time in terms of World Cup history, that brings the question mark as well of, yes, not everyone could go for issues other than sport. Teams ceasing to exist, teams having to focus on war rather than sport. That brings question to it, and of course the political influence that we talked about in 1934 brings a question mark over that. I think there's less of that in the 38 tournament, but yeah, the question of legacy is in terms of who was not there. So how can we, you know, fully celebrate the victors when we don't know how they'd have been against teams who didn't turn up? But in the whole of the history of the tournament, all you can look at is who actually was there and who did win. We can't dwell forever on the great imponderables, I guess, of what might have happened if England were there, or Uruguay were there, or Austria had never been taken over by Germany. Things may have turned out different, but that is the situation at the time of the tournament, and the winners were, without doubt, one of the best teams in the world at the time. So who's to say they wouldn't have won anyway?
You're right. You know, it's an incredibly hypothetical question to guess who would have won it. But it just seems to me that obviously when we did the first episode, and you know, and Paul was talking how difficult this tournament was to almost to get off the ground and to get it going, and then once it had become established, and then three editions in, it just seemed, I suppose it's the Austria situation that, you know, that you talked about that seemed to highlight it to me. It just seems an almost a travesty that one of the greatest teams never got to play in it. It never got to play in it for reasons that weren't, football related. And it just seems to be that those tournaments, had we lived in an idealistic world, could have been so much better and so much more celebrated from a purely football point of view. But you're right, only teams who enter it can win it, and that's how they will always be judged.
Yeah, I mean, it's true that they could have been so much stronger, that there could have been all sorts of great teams going up against each other. But, equally, I think to bring into that mix, and you talked about this a lot on the 1930 episode, of it had to be a success for the World Cup to be able to continue. I think after the initial success of 1930, but you know, issues about the lack of European teams, 34 having been so politically dominated and used to promote a fascist ideal and a fascist regime, I guess you could still view 1938 through that perspective as still sort of fighting for the future of the World Cup. Would it continue? Would it continue to grow? Would it become? We know now, obviously, it became a huge global phenomenon, but at the time, that probably wasn't expected necessarily. It was still a tournament struggling to find its place, and a host of withdrawals, or you know, teams taking the hump and not travelling over, or political influences causing disruption to the tournament in all sorts of ways. Perhaps the World Cup was still struggling to find its feet, and would it continue? Thankfully it did, but I guess at the time that was not certain.
Sorry, Gary.
Yeah. No, great. It's interesting that in a lot of World Cups, I suppose in of more recent times as well, you get these rivals between countries, you know, like the West Germany or Germany and the Dutch and Argentina, Brazil. But in this World Cup, it's almost a case of, it's like two political doctrines, rivalries. There's the Germans and the Italians. And obviously the Germans went out quite early. But can you tell us a little bit about the Italian experience on their way through and how they were received and how they responded, I suppose?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you talk there of rivalries, and the key thing is, for this tournament, to me, the biggest rivalry isn't between two particular teams, although I guess Germany had that within their own team. I think the biggest rivalry was between fascism and democracy. In terms of how the tournament went, and we'll see this a lot through the experience of Italy, the whole thing was played out to a huge backdrop of political protests. So we mentioned this a bit around Germany's match, but for Italy, it was even more so, for a whole number of factors. So Italy, as we know, they won the 1934 tournament, and they also, with a team of students, won the 1936 Olympics. Italian clubs were also making a serious impact in Europe at the time. So they were, just going back to our previous point about how we view the legacy, they were, without doubt, one of the strongest nations around at the time. And as we know, they would, of course, go on to win this 1934 World Cup, which, in terms of the promotion of fascism for the Italian regime, this was seen as the zenith of their sporting achievements. So this was achieved without that home advantage and all the question marks and asterisks that that raised, all the alleged influences that the regime put on referees and other teams and so on. This was achieved without any of that. So, and it was also achieved in the face of all sorts of protests. So this was seen as their biggest achievement. Now, we touched on this a fair bit in the 1934 podcast, but to sort of sum it up in a sort of shorter way, their World Cup wins were the culmination of a lengthy focus on general physical and sporting well-being, or physical well-being of the Italian nation, and this was achieved through sport. Also, the promotion of a national identity, which in a country that was fairly young and a whole load of disparate city-states, it was in need of this sort of something for people to sort of identify with as Italians rather than from separate regions. So this was being promoted both at home and abroad through the use of sport and football in particular. And this is where their biggest successes came, of course. Italy, the political influence is obviously very strong, but they came into the tournament as one of the favourites. But it was always likely to be a fairly tense one, for the regime. Now, there's various incidents that caused this. Mussolini's anti-French or pro-Franco statements just prior to the tournament helped cause all sorts of anti-fascist protests against the Italians specifically. So this is where the protest against Italy was, if anything, stronger than the protest against Germany during this tournament, because Mussolini had been specifically attacking the French on a number of areas. This made, as we would say, the greatest rivalry, one that was played out both on and off the field, of this fascism versus democracy and versus protests issue. It would doggedly throughout, but Italy progressed, obviously, all the way to the end. The anti-Italian protests, there's a bit of a backstory to all of this. So there was a huge Italian exile population in France in the 1930s. Obviously, they share a border. And many anti-fascists had fled the regime, the fascist regime in the homeland, and moved to France, a country that was seen as we talked about earlier, a neutral location, somewhere where they were free to express their political leanings or free to live that way. So one of the most influential among these exiled Italians was a man called Carlo Rosselli. Now, he was a very charismatic anti-fascist intellectual, and he'd been living in France since 1929, which was still some years after the initial takeover of Italy by the fascists, but still a number of years before where we're talking about now. He was rumoured to have been part of all sorts of various plots to assassinate Mussolini. He was very vociferous in his support for an expansion of the Spanish Civil War into a general anti-fascist war through Europe. And as such, of course, he was number one enemy, essentially, for the fascist regime, one of the most dangerous opponents. Now, he was, in fact, killed a year ahead of this World Cup in 1937, but that was rather than by any Italian dealing. This was by a French right-wing group. But his death all simply served to stir up anti-fascist feeling in the exiled community in Italy, as well as in more liberal-minded French communities. His and his brother, who was also killed at the same time, they had a funeral in Paris with more than 100,000 people turning up to see the coffin process. So this was somebody with a huge amount of support in France, both amongst French and Italian exiles. So this is all into the pot for the issues that the Italian team came into. So Mussolini didn't help matters with his statements in May 1938, just a couple of weeks before the World Cup. He declared his support for General Franco in Spain, and he also made that political accord with England that we talked about before, the Easter Accord. So France felt rather vulnerable politically against the Italians too. So the Italian team arrived to the tournament in 1938 against this rather serious backdrop. so the anti-fascist protests basically followed them wherever they went. Now, it was probably their misfortune that their first match against Norway was in Marseille, which is not that far from Italy. And, of course, a huge number of these politically exiled Italians lived in Marseille or in and around Marseille. About 3,000 or so protesters, French and Italian, greeted the team's arrival in there, hurling abuse and various other objects at the team as they arrived, and they had to be held back by baton-wielding mounted police. Of course, the players themselves, I mean, who knows what all of their political leanings actually were, but they were representing the country and, by extension, its regime. So the team were targeted and affected by these protests as they continued in the stadium too when they faced Norway. Now, there's a few issues around this game that went down in sporting or World Cup infamy. They did come past Norway only after extra time. It was a very close, tense match, all to the backdrop of 10,000 or so Italian exiles in the crowd hurling abuse at them non-stop. Now, the thing that caused the biggest controversy in the game was the Italy team at this time performed a Roman salute or a fascist salute at the start of every match. This was something that they had to do by law from the Italian government. This, of course, angered the crowd hugely. Now, they also had come out to the fascist anthem, Giovinezza, as they entered the stadium. Now, that didn't help matters, but Vittorio Pozzo, the Italian coach, took things a little further because he made his players hold their salute in place until all of the boos and abuse had died down. Now, that took a little while, as you can imagine, holding their salute until it had all gone quiet. As soon as it did, they put their hands down, and then he made them do it all again. He told them to put their arms up again. He claimed this was to demonstrate that they had no fear, that they wouldn't be cowed by the abuse they were receiving, but it could also be given as a bit of evidence of Pozzo showing some support for the regime, despite his attempted apolitical stance. He, of course, would claim the players were just wearing the colours of the country, but these colours and insignia just happened to be the fascist ones, of course. After the match, there was also intervention from General Vaccaro, a high-up official in Italy. He was unhappy at the inclusion of a particular ageing player, Eraldo Monzelio, who Pozzo claimed had only been in the team at the insistence of Mussolini, or Mussolini's office, because Monzelio was a tennis coach to Mussolini and his sons, of all things, and that's how he got his place in the team. So Vaccaro's intervention brought an end to Monzelio's international career, but also to political influence in team selection. Now, Pozzo had claimed this had forced him to only pick party members in his team in 1934. Whether the truth of that, I'm not entirely certain. But following this incident, there was certainly less of that issue now. Having got past Norway, only just edging past them, that took them to a quarterfinal with France, of all teams, in Paris. So obviously the protests are going to jump up a notch here. There was another incident, though, that caused extra symbolism politically to this, because both teams would, of course, normally play in blue, as they do now, France and Italy, and lots were drawn to decide who would change. Italy lost this. Now, rather than wear their usual change colour of white, the same as it is now, the team were ordered to play in all black, which is, of course, the colours of the fascist uniforms. So this was an all-black kit with a big fascist symbol on it as its badge. Now, this decision is often thought to have come directly from Mussolini, annoyed at how his team had been received in France and in the opening match, but there is no evidence one way or the other on that. But what it is the only time the black shirts had ever been worn in a full international. So it had the prominent Fascio Littorio symbol on it, as I say. Therefore, it was making a direct representation of the regime in terms of their look. Symbolically, I guess you could see it as two fingers up to the anti-fascist protesters and saying, well, do what we want, we're proud of who we are. Italy won through with their performances actually gaining strength. They beat France and they beat Brazil in the semi-final too. Brazil having rested their star striker for the semi-final, which is another story. Whereas against Norway, they'd struggled in the protests. You know, it clearly had affected them. Possibly there was a greater number of Italians against them in the crowd, and maybe that affected them more on that day. Against France and equally against Brazil, they seemed to draw energy from it. They actually improved. They got better and better. Just briefly on Brazil, I think we should bring that bit into it a little bit. They come past Czechoslovakia in their quarterfinal, and Czechoslovakia, as we said before, they were runners-up the World Cup before in 1934, which of course was a very strong team of the era, but their political situation at home, expecting any invasion any minute, probably meant their minds were elsewhere too. Brazil too were under a dictatorship at the time, and not unlike Mussolini, their dictator Getúlio Vargas was using sport to kind of promote the new Brazil, his ideal of the nation state and his nationalist policy. So even in countries that you might not have expected it, it was still being very politicized in a number of ways. But Italy, it was, who reached the final against Hungary. Now, there's another bit of mythology here, a bit of legend, that there was a telegram sent to the Italian team from Rome ahead of the final. Now, this said, vincere o morire, which literally translated means win or die. Now, that, of course, when you're talking fascist regimes, is a rather chilling note to be sent, but that would be... The myth, of course, is that's meant literally, but really it's more akin to win or bust in terms of an expression, so it's meant to be an encouragement rather than a deadly threat. It doesn't quite fit the more sinister narrative that perhaps some would like to view this through, but that would be taking it a little too literally. But there is, of course, little doubt that the regime saw victory as absolutely vital to their self-promotion. So while this win or die threat wasn't quite the literal truth, it still was absolutely essential to the regime. And I think the players would have been under significant pressure, not in terms of their lives, but certainly in terms of future careers and prospects, that they had to win for the regime. Now, this alleged threat, or at least the mistranslation or misunderstanding of it, was publicly known about at the time. After Italy won the final against Hungary, 4-2, the Hungarian goalkeeper Antal Szabo was quoted as saying that he may have let in four goals, but at least he saved their lives. So that helped promote the myth on one side, but you know, the truth is slightly less threatening. The second victory for the fascist regime was, of course, obvious. So these rumours of corruption during the 1934 tournament, they needed that put right. They wanted to win honestly. They wanted to win clearly to make it a victory on pure footballing terms without any possible talk of influence or anything like that. The fascists, of course, had their eyes on a third consecutive trophy in 1942. Now, that would have been unprecedented even still now, had they done that. The Second World War, of course, put paid to that. But for all of Italy's unquestionable talent and success in this era, and obviously they had a lot of success, they were the leading team at the time in terms of all of these global tournaments. The political gestures that came through in 1938, so the black shirt, the double salute, the overcoming all the protests and so on, this tournament encapsulated the rise of Italian football under fascism, and these clearly significant political gestures, especially in the context of France at the time and what was to come, made it quite a strong political overtone to it all. So while fascism may have won the battle of intimidation on the field, it would ultimately lose the war, as we know in terms of history. But for FIFA and the World Cup, these incidents would definitely go down as one of its least edifying, perhaps, and certainly most overtly political moments in the whole of its history.
Yeah, absolutely. Just for the few guys, people who might sort of not be aware of the history of the Spanish Civil War, Mussolini's Italy and Hitler's Germany obviously were feeding armaments and also troops to support Franco, and the success Italy had on the field was perhaps less successful than the battlefield. One of the few battles that the Republicans won was about the Guadalajara, when the largely Italian, normally volunteer troops who were anything but volunteers, were rescued by the Republicans as they tried to encircle Madrid. And at the same time, another obviously a key thing which also caused a lot of ill feeling for the Italians was they carried out the bombings of Barcelona and Alicante, and I think Valencia, if one says me right, early part of 1938 as well, which was the first time that any air force had bombed civilian civilians on just to sort of incite fear and you know domination and such like. So the feeling against Italy, especially in the southern part of France, where obviously a lot of the Spanish refugees across the border try and get away from the war, was immense, as I had mentioned there. Stu?
It's like I say, to me, when we look at these early World Cups, and obviously we come, you know, the first one post World War II, you know, which is again won by Uruguay, and I think the brilliance of Uruguay in that first tournament and in the Olympics surrounding that first World Cup is very much celebrated, but the brilliance of the Italians, which you know, which Aidan has talked about there and has sort of highlighted and almost brought even more keenly into focus as to how good that Italian side was and potentially could have gone on, you know, and done something unprecedented and won a third successive World Cup in 1942. But I suppose, Aidan, what I'm asking is the brilliance of this, of Italian football in the sort of mid to late 30s, is it lost underneath this political fascist facade that's put out there and the actual brilliance of the football is just, you know, almost secondary?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of question marks, I guess, over a lot of these achievements at the time, and when we view them looking back now, it's easy to question just how, I don't know if valid is the right word, but just how worthwhile they are when compared to other victories in these tournaments. There is little doubt, though, that they were, as we said, one of the best teams around at the time. What we'll never know, I guess, is how they would have fared had the 1934 tournament been held in a different country. And that would have been interesting to know. Imagine if it had been held in Austria with the strong team there. What would have happened? Would it have been different? Unfortunately, of course, we'll never know. And Italy were the winners of them both. And it is certainly conceivable, had there been a 1942 tournament, Italy would have won that again as well, and that would have been unprecedented, as we say. Three tournament wins in a row has not happened to this day still. That would have been quite remarkable. I think it's that there does have to be a question mark over it, and the question mark when we view it looking back now is that they were achieved not only in the name of a fascist regime and a fascist country, but also for that regime, and the achievements such as they were hailed as because of the regime and because of the new Italy that they'd provide, that they were going for, and so on. But equally, as we discussed a lot on the 1934 one, it was a construct of the regime. It was entirely the regime and the fascist regime's influence that caused football to become, firstly, more and more popular, but equally to actually raise the standards up to a much higher level. And then it was political influence and political decisions that caused the Oriundi, the foreign players, primarily from South America, to come and play in Italy, to strengthen the team both in terms of player ability and tactical knowledge. So their achievements were entirely a construct of the fascist regime. Therefore, it is, yeah, there will be that question mark over it always because of that.
Do you think history struggles to separate the fascist regime and the talent of the Italian football side? Do you think history struggles to be able to do that?
I think it's less known compared to, say, the 1936 Olympics and the influence there. I think that is a much better, more widely known story of political influence or political symbolism. Whereas Italy in 1934 and the 38 victory, I don't know that as many people would view them in that way as they might do about those Olympic Games. Certainly, I don't think as many people would know that Italy were only that good because of the fascists. I think that would be not as well understood. People might suspect and know about interference in the hosting and the promotion of fascists through the hosting of the 34 tournament. But I don't think as many people would understand that Italy's success was in almost entirely down to the fascists and their influence in ways away from the actual tournament itself. So I think in many ways history views them as footballing successes, but there is definitely an undertone to them that purely through the time, the era they were in, everyone knows that Italy was a fascist country at that time. Mussolini was wanting to promote himself, and they are viewed slightly negatively because of that. I just don't think that the actual wider context of how fascism influenced it all in way in advance of it in terms of Italian football development, I don't think that side of it would be as understood, and therefore it would be questioned less because people would just see Italy as one of the best teams.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
I think that's absolutely true. Just on a set of links there, I mean, you get obviously a lot of World Cup tournaments are won by host nations, or the host nations fare really well. And obviously that wasn't particularly true in France because the Italians beat them. Do you think is it fair to say that the Italians were probably the most disliked world champions?
Probably yes. I can't recall any other team throughout the World Cup history. I'm trying to rack my brain now, but I'm pretty sure that there's never been a team that's been this abused throughout every single match they played. And outside the matches too, who actually went on to win the whole thing. So yes, I think that's the answer to that one.
Fair play. Yeah, Stu?
I think, from in a summing up way, Aidan, is there anything either on record of with regards to Jules Rimet's perception of almost of what appears to me to be the hijacking of his brainchild? You know, we talked about in episode one with Paul how much credit. You know, I never fully understood how difficult this tournament, the World Cup, was to get off the ground, to get it to work, for it to become an entity, and obviously the thing it has become. But sort of these early editions, certainly 34, 38, seem to have been politically hijacked. And I wonder if there's anything whereby what is his opinion of what was happening to his tournament, or whether he was, you know, again, as we discussed in 30, almost did whatever it took to get for this tournament to get a foothold. And, you know, and you've mentioned that as well before the war, that he was quite happy for it to go ahead as it was, so long as it was happening. He was relatively happy for it to be happening under any guise, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think there's a fair element of that that would be true to say, that it was expanding. You know, the qualification tournament for this was slightly bigger than the one for 34, and there hadn't been one at all for 1930. So that, I think, was the most dominating thought to him, was to see it continue to grow, and therefore the fact that one team was universally loathed and, as we say, the most unloved World Cup winners in history, I think probably he wasn't overly concerned about that from, I haven't seen anything say otherwise. And I think his general thoughts from what I've seen is more about continuing to grow and make the World Cup a viable entity. But notwithstanding that, we talked a bit about how it was awarded and how that came about. And the intention, largely from Jules Rimet, as well as others, was for a more neutral host compared to 1934. So they had certainly been stung by what happened there, and, of course, obviously by what happened in the 1936 Olympics. This tournament was awarded just off or around the same time as that 36 Olympics, so that was very fresh in their minds when it came to awarding this tournament. It could have been safer to go to South America, well away from all these political turmoils in Western Europe, but they didn't do that. France was still seen as a neutral, politically neutral, not neutral as in Switzerland neutral, but, you know, not such a controversial host, shall we say, neutral in terms of political influence on a tournament to that extent. So, yes, they had very much been burned by the experience of 1934 and were very much wary of what had happened in 1936 at the Olympics. They avoided that, I guess you could say, in 1938. They didn't have the host causing such controversy or influencing matters or allegedly influencing matters. So perhaps, yes, they were successful in avoiding that, but what they couldn't avoid, and this possibly would have been the case had it been in South America too, there were lots of Italians living there as well, whether they were politically against the regime is another question, though. The choice of venue probably actually made that factor worse for them. I think that was just misfortune of Italy happening to be very, very good, and therefore all the pronunciations of Mussolini and all the various incidents that they'd become embroiled with and the huge number of politically exiled Italians just made that a sort of a kindle ready to be lit and to explode. It was unfortunate from that area, but I think they tried to mitigate it. But to come back to the beginning, I think the primary desire was just to continue to see the tournament grow, and therefore, from that point of view, it was a success.
Okay, thank you.
I mean, at this sort of stage of the pods, I always say, you know, hack the damn clock, because it's so much, I say, fun, and it's entertaining, and it's educational as well, listening, you know, to experts such as yourself, Aidan, who've been wonderful, absolutely wonderful this evening. But I want to sort of give you a sort of closing question. I had to do it differently with the first one we did last time with Paul 1930, because it was the first tournament. But this is going to be the sort of general one I'm going to go for going forward. So, obviously, we look at the World Cup now in recent times, you know, and we think, oh, the political interference of the World Cup is massive. But, you know, as you, Paul, have pointed out magnificently, even going back to the pre-Second World War tournament, political interference was also massive then. So the question I'm going to ask you is this. Do you think the tournament of 1938 was more or less influenced by politics? And or is it a case of it was just influenced in different ways than modern tournaments are?
Okay, so it was a bit of a unique situation, of course, because there was a world war imminent and all sorts of these key events that were leading into that had either already happened, were happening at the time, or in a few cases were about to happen. All the situation was all still there. So that was something that I guess more recent tournaments don't have to deal with quite to that extent. We mentioned how it escaped the overt political influence that the 1934 tournament suffered, but obviously the impact of the ongoing and impending conflicts meant it was deeply affected by the political situation at the time. I think what we haven't seen in more recent cases quite to this extent is obviously a country that was a contender for a tournament simply ceasing to exist on the eve of a tournament. You know, that's certainly quite unique, I think. Countries have, of course, ceased to exist. They may have been strong in World Cups, say Yugoslavia, Soviet Union and so on, but not quite in the way has happened in this tournament. So that would have been much more clear political change or political influence than anything we've seen more recently. A combination of events politically obviously happens around many World Cups, but not to this extent. I mean, to that extent, it certainly doesn't happen around every World Cup tournament. There's always ongoing political concerns. I mean, Russia was questioned for a lot of how it treated its citizens and how it treated other nations in international politics. But the tournament itself didn't end up being overtly political once we got into it. Qatar has obviously got a lot of political-related issues and sociological issues and so on around it, but none of that's quite to this extent. But there will always be conflicts of some description going on. I think there'll be opposing political regimes might be facing off against each other in a match, which could be a big incident. That didn't happen in 1938, and that's something that can and does happen in more recent times. Any incident that involves competing nations, and particularly the host nation, will have some bearing on teams at the World Cup, especially if there is any particular conflict going on. That happens a little bit. You know, it would have been a big issue had Ukraine qualified for the Russia World Cup. That, of course, didn't happen, and we can speculate, I guess, about how that might have been perceived had they been there. They'd have had to play in Russia when they were technically being occupied partially by the Russians. I believe that they can't be drawn together in qualifying groups. I think that's right at the minute. Yeah. So that would have been quite an issue. Not quite on the par with Austria disappearing and being swallowed up by Germany, but it still would have been a hugely political issue that was avoided and could easily have happened. You know, Ukraine could quite easily, quite conceivably have been there. It would have been quite interesting to know what would have happened there, but I can't imagine it would have been pleasant. But I think through back in the 1930s and all the tournaments since, and just as true today, national football teams are representatives of their nation, both in its name, its flag, its colours, its identity, and its people, and its government as well, of course. So while the team and the players may not subscribe to the political stance of their country or even have any political interest whatsoever, they are representing their country, and therefore they're a symbol of it too. This is just as true in the past as it is now. So in the same way that prime ministers, presidents, generals, soldiers, and so on are all symbols and representing their country, so too are the football team and its players. And as such, they were open to the influences of how their nations conducts itself internationally and how it's perceived internationally. And I think international sport in general, much more than the club game, and this is another of the reasons why I'm so much more intrigued by it than the club game, it's inherently political for these reasons. So the World Cup will always, I think, have this political link, which is great for your series, obviously. I do think the unique situation of 1938 with the world poised as it was in so many areas, and how much of this, which hopefully we've conveyed in here, had a bearing on the tournament, even in teams who didn't take part or may not have had a massive impact on the tournament, even if they had taken part. The whole political situation affected so much of that I think is more than would happen today. But it's a factor that's always there. And obviously the next tournament in Qatar is going to have a lot of these political questions and issues about the workers and all that kind of thing. It's going to become increasingly talked about and increasingly important, at least hopefully it is. But I don't see it as being as strongly politically influenced as this was back in 1938. And you still see huge political clashes. So look at 1998, USA against Iran. They, you know, it's just two sets of players who on the field were very friendly with each other, but they represented hugely opposed regimes. That could have been similar to the Ukraine and Russia situation had it occurred in 2018. It's an inevitability that as they're representing their country and representing them globally, this will always have a bearing on it. But yeah, 1938 was so unique that I don't think we'll see it quite like that in today's tournaments.
Well, I mean, obviously, a world war followed it, so let's hope that's right.
It kind of trumps everything, doesn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely does, yeah. Any final thoughts, Stu?
I expect the average pass rate of history GCSE to go up in May. But like I say,
you ready for the test now?
Yeah. Oh, oof. It's fascinating. You know, it's absolutely fascinating. I think when you certainly listen to that last answer that you gave there, Aidan. I think when you put the context of, and you know, hindsight's great, but when you put into context how close the world was to global warfare and how devastating that warfare was, and yet you had this tournament being played out so close to it happening. You know, it's almost unthinkable when, and you started off with the sort of the setting the scene, if you like, around the world and what was going on in terms of global conflicts, regimes, etc. It seems incredulous almost to think that this tournament went ahead, and as you said there, it was relatively unpoliticized in the grand scheme of things compared to what was going on outside the microcosm of the football fields in France.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's certainly unique.
Yeah. It's when we'll sort of talk about this during this series, the pre-World Cups were going to be difficult ones for us. And I didn't know a great deal about it. I mean, obviously, done a little research, and this has been a massively informative couple of episodes from Paul in the first episode and Aidan tonight, who have, you know, shared some wonderful knowledge and information with us about and filled in so many gaps about these pre-World War tournaments. So massive thanks for that, Aidan.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been absolutely great. I really, really enjoy going into these historical tournaments and back in the midst of time. There's so much to find out about them that just, as you say, isn't that well known. So merely preparing and gathering all my thoughts and notes for this has been an education for me as well, for some of the things that I didn't know so much about, and it makes it really, really interesting. So thanks for the opportunity to do it.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you've enjoyed it, because I've mentioned earlier, it's all your perishing fault anyway, that we're
yes.
we're doing the World Cup series. And massive thanks. I mean, we're joking aside. Massive thanks, Aidan. That was brilliant. So we've covered the pre-World Cup, the pre-World War World Cups now. In our next episode, we'll be jumping forward almost 30 years to 1966. I can't remember who won it then, but we'll perhaps discover next week, next time when we return with the political Football World Cup series. So thanks for listening, and catch us again next time. Bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.